Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for November 11th, 2010. I'm reporter Elise Hugh, joined by the whole gang. We're all back. CEO and editor-in-chief Evan Smith.
Hello.
Managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Ben Philpott from the Tribune and KUT News.
I turned 39 this weekend.
Happy birthday.
You do. You know, my wife actually said to me the other day, can you believe Ben Philpott is not yet 40? And I thought, no. In fact, he seems much older.
I remember well when I was not yet 40.
You're a silver fox. Today.
Oh, well, he's silver, at least. I'm not sure he's much of a fox, but that's why he's on the podcast as opposed to video.
Fox on the radio.
Moving on. Our four topics today are the pre-filed bills at the Texas legislature, the two-thirds rule in the Senate, will it survive, Republicans versus Republicans next session, and Republican Governor Rick Perry and his book tour. So I'll start with all the bills. We joined State Representative Debbie Riddle for the last part of her camp out this weekend. She camped out from Saturday until Monday morning when the clerk's office opened at 8 a.m.
It's got to be more fun when the payoff is Grateful Dead tickets if you're going to camp out overnight, right?
She camped out and to file 9 bills, the first of which was voter ID. The rest had to do with immigration, some pretty strong anti-immigration bills. She wasn't the only one who filed them. Dan Patrick on the Senate side filed the Arizona-style immigration bill, which allows police to ask for the immigration status of anyone they are reasonably suspicious of, and allows for immunity of the folks, of the officers, from suit.
Can't be sued for it.
Yeah. And so some interesting things coming up next session. We also saw some bills that we've seen before that will probably stand a better chance, like the ultrasound, women having to see an ultrasound of a fetus before getting an abortion. That passed the Senate last session but was not able to pass the House in the whole chubbing deal.
I don't think we're going to be able to say passed the Senate and was not able to pass the House this time.
And it would be quite a feat for something to pass the Senate and not pass it. Well, this is, Ross has written in the Tribune recently about, what the consequences of the number 99 are.
Right.
One of the consequences is that a bunch of issues like abortion that may not have been on an agenda taken up largely with the budget and redistricting, now suddenly those may come up because the Republicans probably think they've got a 2-year window.
Right.
They can't say that they're going to have 99 next time because the maps may not allow for 99 safe seats. They've got to do all their business now.
And the joke going around now is that voter ID might as well be on local and consent.
Right.
The schedule.
Exactly, on the express train as opposed to the local train. That's exactly
right. I had a Republican.
You got to call it express and consent.
Right.
Exactly.
One Republican member told me, just kind of half in jest, that he was sorry to see Jim Dunham go, the leader of the Democrats. And I said, well, why is that? And he said, there's a lot of stuff that I didn't really want to vote on that I couldn't vote on because Jim Dunham wouldn't let me, and now Jim Dunham's not there to stop it.
Wow. So.
Well, you broke it, you bought it, right? The Pottery Barn rule, as ever in effect. You guys wanted to run things when there's a $25 billion budget shortfall? Go ahead. Take it.
Right.
And then they're going to have to suddenly vote on stuff and stand behind stuff. And one of the constant themes of the last week, from not just Democratic consultants but Republicans debriefing about the election, is the guys who got elected this time talking about strangling government in the cradle, shrinking the size of government, are going to have a hell of a time going home and explaining to the people who elected them.
Oh, hey, we couldn't fund your nursing home.
Or conversely, actually, we couldn't cut, even though we promised to cut, because this governing stuff is hard.
Well, or that they can actually go home and say, we did it. It was hard, and, that's why they didn't do it before, but I did it, and I promised to cut, and we cut, and you got a shrunken government, and that's what you voted for.
Even though your public schools and your health care and your everything else is, a percentage
wanted,
of the size.
That's what you wanted.
You get
winning.
The government you want,
right? Yeah.
Which is ultimately the government you deserve.
What else stood out to you in those bills, Ben?
They're just... I think Emily Ramshaw had this earlier in the week about the idea of people filing for, getting the state out of Medicaid. There was also a bill that would consolidate Higher Education Coordinating Board and TEA.
Robert Scott, the head of TEA, told me today, by the way, he said, yeah, that's a great idea. For one thing, I couldn't run TEA if that were the case because I'm not qualified to preside over the Higher Education Coordinating Board.
So he's
a moment of candor, right? he'll be Secretary of Education in the Perry administration.
May have just heard his exit strategy.
that goes back to what you were talking about, Evan, with the the idea of you've made all these campaign promises to cut this, cut that, shrink the size of government. But is it even efficient to say TEA and higher education are now all in one pot.
But there's an argument. The interesting thing is there's an argument. You know, I sat yesterday on a panel at lunch hour with, among other people, Fred Heldenfels, who is the appointed chair of the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board, appointed by Perry. He runs a stressed concrete company in San Marcos. He was appointed as a member of the board, and then in May was appointed to chair the board. And, you know, you talk to Heldenfels and other people on that board, they talk about the K-16 pipeline.
Well.
And so the notion of combining the Higher Education Coordinating Board and the TEA is not completely without some rationale. It's just a question of whether, from a process standpoint, it can be managed. Are those tasks too enormous, independent of one another, to be combined?
Well, and that, you know, that's, I guess, what we're going to find out as some of these bills move forward. Is there a rationale behind them, or is there simply a bottom line, let's cut this budget item, behind it, and how those two mix?
The part that if you're right about this, and you really are wrong, Ross, about this, Ross said to me the other day, you know, if you put education and health and human services to the side, and you cut every other part of the budget, not by a percentage, you cut every other part of the budget completely, you still don't get the $25 billion, right?
Such a big part.
I mean, the people in the education and healthcare communities are sitting there going, "Oh God, what's coming?"
Right. Yeah, it's concentric circles on them. It's that old Far Side cartoon where the birds look down and the top of everybody's head has a target on it.
I have to tell you that I thought that one of the more interesting, not unexpected, but one of the more interesting pre-filed bills was my Brooklyn homie, Leo Berman, filing to indeed strip birthright citizenship
again.
Again, I mean, is this not a constitutional issue?
Can urge Congress. They can urge them emphatically. They can urge them.
I can urge Leo Berman to put on a dress and sing a Bon Jovi song on Glee, but it doesn't mean it's going to happen. I mean, you can urge. Why, when we have real problems, are we in the urging business? What are we wasting our time with this stuff for?
Well, he just filed the resolution. He didn't file a bill for it as well.
Well, you can't do it.
No, I thought he filed. He filed a bill.
I know he filed.
He said he intended to.
A bill in the past. And his point is, he wants it to go to the courts. He wants someone at a lower level to say it's unconstitutional because he is positive that when it gets to the Supreme Court, he will win.
Does he have to pay for the frivolous lawsuit?
You guys, we have a $25 billion budget shortfall. Look, let me even take the Smarty Pants Ogden number and say that it's actually $12 billion. We have a $12 billion budget. What are we screwing around with this stuff for? I mean, I don't understand.
99.
Especially since you can't. Well, yes, but especially if it's a constitutional issue, what are we screwing around with?
Well, Debbie Riddle says her voters care about this issue the most. It is the
birthright
highest.
Citizens.
No, here, immigration.
Here's an argument. If you're going to amend the United States Constitution, you need Congress to vote, and then you need the states to ratify. And if you're on the other end of this argument, you say, well, if I can get 33 or 34 states to send resolutions to Congress saying we're ready to ratify, pass it, that's the argument.
Perhaps.
Yeah. No. Berman's entitled to do what he wants, of course. I mean, I understand that. And you're right, Elise. In a lot of places around this state, lawmakers were elected taking a hard line on immigration. Hell, Patrick Rose was defeated taking a hard line on immigration. I mean, it took Democrats had to even gravitate to that position just to try to save themselves, and many of them didn't. I don't disagree with that, but goodness gracious, the agenda is full of things that have to get done.
Sure.
Right?
Well, let's talk about what the legislature is going to be able to get done. So assuming a lot of these bills are able to sail through the House, what happens in the Senate? There's a lot of talk about the two-thirds rule, which protects the minority in the Senate, essentially being the wall for the minority party, the Democrats there.
I thought the minority party of the legislature was white Democratic women.
Right.
I'm sorry.
That's for sure.
So, you know, you already have Dan Patrick's first year as a senator in the state Senate, a Republican from Houston. He immediately put forward a rule change that would, you know, get rid of the two-thirds rule completely. He lost 30-1 on that first vote back in 2007. But the Senate the last time did pass an exemption for voter ID at the beginning of their session to allow voter ID through without two-thirds. The idea this time is either you pass additional exemptions, you pass additional voter ID, redistricting, immigration, or as Dan Patrick wants to do, you pass a new rule that says instead of two-thirds, it's 60%, which is 18 votes. There are 19 Republicans in the Senate. And he says he's got 6 or 7 people that are ready to join him on that.
So far.
I mean, he's still working the room. He's still trying to get more. And he has, I think, he's created a Tea Party caucus within the Texas legislature.
Well, he gave up on my favorite caucus, which was ICROT, was the Independent Conservative Republicans of Texas. I just think it's a great name for a PAC.
ICROT.
Yeah, it's like that thing you get between your toes.
Maybe you do.
Yeah.
But he starts this Tea Party caucus.
It's been abolished now.
any Republican in the Senate who joins this Tea Party caucus is going to be told, and why aren't you voting for the 60% rule?
Well, the thing about the two-thirds rule is that you either hand the Senate over to the caucuses or you don't. And if you have a simple majority rule, then you settle issues in the caucus of the majority party. The Republicans go aside and settle it and come out and vote, and the Democrats get crushed, or the Democrats, if they're in the majority, same thing. A 60% rule with 19 Republicans does virtually the same thing. And you know, the Senate has to determine whether, as individual senators, they want to turn this up, because not every vote is partisan. In fact, many votes aren't partisan, and this two-thirds floats around. Two-thirds today may be Democrats versus Republicans. Two-thirds tomorrow may be business versus trials. Two-thirds the next day may
rural
be...
Rural versus urban. There's
a million ways to...
And by the way, one day, two-thirds may be two-thirds of a Democratic majority. And so if you change a rule like this, you got to be careful that it doesn't come back around to bite you when the majority changes.
They made a strong argument against changing the two-thirds rule when it was really in crisis. The Senate in crisis. All the Democrats were over in Albuquerque. And except for one, and that Democrat and all the Republicans, Ken Armbrister, who's now working for the governor, were sort of talking about, do we get rid of the two-thirds rule? And Armbrister made a really great argument for not doing it. All the power of an individual senator comes from the fact that on any given issue, he or she might be the last vote on that one-third that's blocking something.
Where does the dew come down on this?
Well, all his power goes away if this goes to the caucuses, right? I mean, if the direction of the Senate's determined by what happens in a Republican caucus or the Democratic caucus, that means it's not determined in the lieutenant governor's office.
And yet, if the Dew intends to run for governor,
it's very, very interesting.
He needs the Tea Party guys to be with him.
Well, and the Republican Party. The Republican Party is against this thing. I mean, if you put this to voters
saying if I called Ministeri right now, he would say we're against two-thirds rule being limited?
I'm not sure if it's in the platform or not.
Well, it was one of the propositions in their primary in March. You know the Republican Party, you can list
your
own little, hey, do you want to do this? Do you want to do that as part of the Republican primary?
Non-binding propositions on the primary.
Do you want to get rid of two-thirds rule was one of them. I think immigration was another.
And what was the result of that?
Oh, it was like 90% or something. I mean, it was a very high. Yeah.
Bambi versus Godzilla.
But, you know, I talked to a political scientist yesterday also about this story, and he said, you know, that he thought that Dan Patrick was being short-sighted, not in the Democrats could be the 60% one day soon and then Republicans are screwed, but in the two-thirds rule in the Senate is the wall between ultra-conservative bills then becoming ultra-conservative laws that could hurt the Republicans in future elections. So let's say that a really harsh immigration policy, you know, gets through the House 99-51, gets into the Senate, instead of being blocked, it's then, you know, passes, it then goes on to the governor's office, he signs it into law. That could hurt with Hispanic voters, who they made inroads with in this past election.
Oh, the political implications. Yeah, and the other thing about a lot of these bills actually winding up on the desk of the governor is it actually forces the governor to decide on some of these things that hasn't been too clear on, like the Arizona immigration bill.
And especially, I know we're jumping topics, I'm not looking to jump topics, but as you get into a pre-Rick Perry presidential campaign, how the governor weighs in on some of these issues that end up on his desk, very interesting.
Well, there were any number of things when the last time we did this presidential thing, when the legislature kind of protected George Bush from having to vote on this or that, you know, just don't bring me
that. You think the legislature will protect Rick Perry?
Well, that's a question. I mean, what do they mean
99.
By protecting him?
I think 99 and get rid of the two-thirds rule when you can't protect him.
Let's look deeper into the 99 with Ross's topic and the coming schism between, or I guess in the Republican.
The coming schism? Yeah. They're, you know, little camps are meeting right now.
We're mid schism right now.
Right,
right. It's been schizzed.
We're astride the
cap. That's right. Sid Miller versus Leo Berman.
You know, the history of one party states is that the one party turns into two parties. You know, Texas didn't, under the Democrats, was the Yarboroughs versus the Connollys. I mean, you had liberal Democrats and conservative Democrats. Now we've got moderate Republicans and conservative Republicans, and we've got, you know, or you can slice it this way. You can say we've got fiscal conservatives and social conservatives. Or you can say, you know, I mean, there's a million ways to slice it, but the fight is over on the red side of the aisle. And these two parties are emerging. Now, Joe Strauss is sort of seen as, you know, this is an old Republican family in Texas. His mom was one of the people who, you know, was making sure that each county had a Republican primary
when
back
it wasn't
in the day.
Cool.
Right, right.
And this is his point to those guys. Right. I was a Republican back then. What were you?
He was working for John Tower and Lamar Smith.
Ronald Reagan?
Back in the day.
His line is, yeah, when I was working for Reagan, Warren Chisholm was probably a Democrat.
He was certainly a Democrat, actually. So was Rick Perry, by the way. And then you've got these new guys who've come in and said, you know, basically we're against all the things that you institutional Republicans have been doing. All of you people who've been here for a while have screwed this up, so we're coming in to fix this. And that's a difference in the party. And it's a thing any Republican leader has to straddle now. And I think probably, you know, at least for now, the big fights in the legislature are going to be in primaries, not general elections.
Do you think that they're, so on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 is no chance, no way, no how. 10 is lock it down, put it in ink, certain. Where is Strauss being reelected between that scale of 1 to 10?
It's an 8 or a 9.
Yeah, I'd say 9.
But it's not a 10.
It's not a 10. And, you know, there's 2 months to work here. There's not much else going on. There are a lot of idle hands. There are not idle hands.
There are a lot of people with pitchforks in their idle hands.
Well, there's a lot of people.
To do mischief.
There are a fair number of people with followings, David Barton being one, who's a former vice chairman.
Well, he can't be speaker.
He can't be speaker, but they have followings outside. The Republicans call these the hounds, and they sort of set off the hounds, and the hounds go hounding the people who are in office and ring their phones and say, you shouldn't vote for this guy or you should vote for that guy. All that stuff's going.
The Young Republicans of Texas put out a very long list today comparing some conservative score. I don't know what methodology they used, but they had the chairman from the 81st legislature and the chairman from the 80th legislature.
80th was undercratic.
Undercratic. And almost 2-1, the ones under the 80th received a higher conservative score than the ones under the 81st.
Well, because a lot of the ones under the 81st were Democrats. That's
right.
One of the issues that...
Republicans, you know, you had Warren Chisholm with an 80, whatever that means, and then Jim Pitts with a 40 in House Appropriations.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, he who has the most toys wins. The rule is always in effect. Democrats lost all their toys this election, so the Republicans now get to decide.
Right.
And, you know, the upshot of this, which you've written, Ross, is that no matter who the speaker is going to be more conservative than the last speaker.
Well,
Speaker makes that point.
Well, this is interesting, though. To the extent that some Republicans rebel against management, let's just put it that way, the number of Republicans who rebel against management have to be replaced. You got to get votes for this stuff. You have to have 2/3 to vote for getting into the rainy day fund and not having a tax bill. There's $9 billion over there. Do you want to spend it? We have to have 2/3. If these guys say no, then whoever's in management has to deal with Democrats in proportion to the number of people who've said no to this. So the conservatives, in some ways, could end up working against themselves. The peel off of Strauss goes to the Democrats for his votes, and it's a less conservative vote.
If Strauss is not the speaker, who's the speaker?
Either Warren Chisholm or Larry Taylor, I would say.
You think Larry Taylor is emerging as...
He's the head of the House Republican Caucus.
As that potential.
He's
non-Chisholm, non-Strauss.
He's got an ability. He's a conservative guy. He's got an ability to work across the aisle. He's from Friendswood. He's shown an ability to work across the aisle. The conservatives listen to him. A lot of the moderates listen to him. It's, you know, we'll see.
Right. He's been hating on Mostyn for the last couple of weeks, and so that's probably serves him in good standing with his
absolutely.
Folks, right?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Perfect foil to the state's formerly richest trial lawyer, at least in politics. Mostyn spent $9.2 million in this race.
But of course, if you're Strauss, what you're thinking is, at the absolute height of the Craddock era, they had 88 Republicans. I come in for one term as speaker, I get 99 Republicans. Hello?
Yeah.
Little help here, you know. Don't I get any credit for this?
That's one of the arguments.
Yeah. Don't you think?
That's his case, yeah. So our last topic of the day is Rick Perry.
We'll do it as a fast one.
Well, what can we say?
Here's what I want to say. I want to give a little props to the governor. The governor went on this national tour, and you know what? He didn't drool on himself. He didn't do anything to diminish.
This is props, right?
It is. Well, look, he didn't. Yes, it's props.
Okay, fine.
He did not diminish himself as a potential national candidate in any way, from what I can tell over these couple days. I thought he helped himself.
I'd say he enhanced it.
You know, he went on Jon Stewart, and he sparred with the great master, and I thought he actually held his own. He fought Jon Stewart to a draw at worst. He did fine on national TV, on the Today Show, and on this, that, and the other. Look, the guy has a message. And there, you know, I know there are people in this state, including a bunch of Republicans, who don't much like him. But let's acknowledge that he went out there and in his first spin around the country did pretty well.
I think one of the most interesting ones was his NPR interview. Now, I'll be a little biased.
I didn't hear this,
but I mean,
yes.
his NPR interview, he came across as a
Who did he talk to? Juan Williams?
No, he wasn't.
Kidding.
He came across as a moderate Republican who spent the last 2 minutes of his interview talking about his outreach with the Muslim community in Texas.
When did that happen?
To a different audience, NPR. He had to wear a turtleneck for it.
He did. I mean, he had
a dickie. He had to wear a dickie.
He had patches on his tweed jacket. I mean, it was. But he played to that audience, right?
Did he do Pledge?
He did not.
That's right.
But
started talking about Oh Dark 30. What did he do actually?
He played to the audience. He didn't come off. He didn't sound fake as he played to the audience.
Any guy who's been in public office for 25 years and can run as an outsider can also be as conservative as he's been and come across as a moderate. I mean, you know, that's a hell of an act, don't you think?
He did a great job. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was from his standpoint, if he is running for something, it was a good interview.
We should point out he has said again and again and in all of these national interviews that he is not running for
president. It's on the first page of his book. I did not write this book to run for president.
Everybody who's running for president says they're not running for president.
Why would he go on Jon Stewart if you were not running for president? Why subject yourself?
Well, you know the story. I mean, his version of this is I want to lead a national conversation about federalism and states' rights and pulling things back. You know, the best line about his book, Fed Up, is that they left out the apostrophe. It should have been effed up. Mm-hmm. Nice line.
That would have been a Democrat's book.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you know, Perry's kind of pointing his middle finger at Washington. It kind of works either way. But he's got this. He's got something to talk about, which distinguishes him from all the other Republican presidential wannabes. There's something. Right. You know, Perry's about something. All these other guys are well-known names. Newt Gingrich. Oh yeah, I've heard of him. And Mitt Romney. I've heard of him
because he cheated on his wife when she was dying. But that's why I've heard of him.
Perry's got a surfboard and a wave here, and we'll see how he goes with it.
Well, there's no Minnesota miracle for Tim Pawlenty to talk about, and there's no South Dakota miracle for John Thune to talk about. But you know, Perry's got a record to run on. Now people will object to it. They say he didn't do anything.
The Massachusetts miracle is played out now. You know.
You see how he's attacking Romney this week? Yeah, he's not running for president. What's the point of him attacking Romney?
I think he wants to be drafted.
What is the point of him attacking Romney if he's not running for president?
To elevate his national, brand so that he may be a Sarah Palin-type figure. I mean, I just think he would be so much more effective.
She's not running for president.
Well, she's being talked about too, I suppose. I just think Perry would more likely want to be a vice presidential running mate than an actual.
Allow me to say now, and not for the last time, please God, let him run for president. It will be so much more interesting if he does.
That brings us to an end this week's podcast. On behalf of Evan, Ross, Ben, our producer Todd, and myself, thanks for listening.